My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak about how a physical injury ended up in a suicide attempt. We speak about military service, deployments, and why community is so important. We also talk about psychological recovery and how magic mushrooms changed his outlook. Episode 48, Stephen Japp. This is Declassified.
Childhood was relatively pain-free, considering being born with ginger hair. Mum was a good, she was a good mum. She was a proper housewife. She ran a really good house, kept a really clean, tidy, well-maintained house. Dad was a main breadwinner. He was involved in the sort of the oil and gas industry. We grew up in a place called Falkirk, so not far away from a big BP oil refinery. So he was employed there throughout his whole sort of the early stages of his career. So yeah, he was the main breadwinner. He was home sort of 50% of the time, away 50% of the time. So a lot of the time it was just me and my mum. So I wasn't a mummy's boy by any stretch of the imagination, but yeah, she looked after me most of the time.
And when you say away, for what period of time was he away?
Yeah, sometimes it would be, you know, weekends away, sometimes it would be months away. But as he progressed in his career, the further afield he started to get sent. So he started to then work in France. He then went and lived in France. Him and my mum eventually separated due to that move, because he was working in France full time. And from France, he then went all over the world, to Indonesia, South Africa. He lived all over the world, so yeah.
When did the separation happen?
It was roughly, I was about 14 or 15 year old, roughly the time we built a house, which brings its own stresses and its own strifes. But he was trying to build it remotely. I think he was working in South Africa at the time, and it was just, the thing was just not going according to plan. And it gave him so many problems. And my mum was just a little old housewife trying to do the best she could with a bunch of hairy ass builders sort of there. Knocking around, so that caused a whole host of problems. So the marriage eventually broke down. So and he just lived out the rest of his days in France. He still came home. We still had a relationship and stuff. But it was just me and my mum from when we were around 14, 15.
But was it, what was the environment like then up until that point? Was it fractured? Was it a safe environment?
Safe. I was again not a mummy's boy, but I was well protected. My dad looked after me as well. He was always there for advice. Keep me in line. My mum was always there to sort of mollycoddle me, do all the sort of mummy stuff. But yeah, it wasn't a fractured childhood at all. It was a relatively happy. I had a good core of friends. I played sport when I was at school, so I was, you know, involved in the rugby team and stuff like that. So I had a good core of friends around me. I wasn't a great that. I wasn't academically, you know, astute to say the least. I just wanted to play rugby. You know, 3:30 was when my day started at school, because that's when the bell rang and that's when we could get changed into a rugby kit. So yeah, school academically I wasn't that great, but I didn't really apply myself, if I'm being totally honest.
I mean, energy can be redirected in different ways. Was it a healthy upbringing? Nutritious, with the food you were eating, with the lifestyle you was leading?
Yeah, I got involved in sport quite early on, so I got quite quite bitten by the fitness and health aspect of training and playing rugby. So I was well looked after, well fed. My parents did a lot for me when I think back at it. Now even when I refer to, like, I wasn't academically that gifted, they made allowances for that when I was at school. I had a mathematics teacher that used to come in and see me after school. I had a history teacher as well, just to try and bump my grades up a little bit. Because, like I say, with the best intentions, as soon as the school bell rang, I just could not focus, could not apply myself the way that I should have been able to.
Was there stresses in life? Was there financial stresses? Was there bullying? Was there anything like that?
Nah, there was a tiny little bit of bullying when I was at school. Again, it goes back to the red hair thing. But there was a little bit of bullying. That didn't last long, to be honest. It was, and classically, my dad dealt with it in the only way he could. I remember getting chased home from school one time by a group of guys that were all wanting to beat me up. And I met my dad, who was walking down towards school with a dog. And he just saw me in an angry mob chasing me back up the road. And he's like, "What's going on?" And I said, "You know, they want to beat me up." And he about turned me and he walked me back down there. And he made me fight three of the tough guys out of the hole. He made me stand there and fight all three of them. And I was like, right, okay, that's that dealt with. So that was how my Friday afternoon ended, one afternoon. Yeah, a square go with three of the kids, the school bullies. But But the enormous amount of backing that you had, having your old man in the corner, yeah, mm. mate, I battered all three of them. So.
Was he a good role model to you?
Yeah, yeah. He was, across the board, I couldn't have asked for a better father, to be honest. He was always there. From a young age, he was always there. And even when I was growing up, even when I was a, you know, a grown man, and he was working all over the world, he was always, always there at the end of a phone, always, mate. And when he wasn't able to, he would make allowances or he'd do some. He was always able to communicate with me in one way, shape, or form. Mm. He really. I think he was conscious of the fact that he made a life for himself working abroad, so he made that choice to work away from his family. So I think he sort of then felt a little bit empowered to sort of maintain that relationship and work hard at that relationship to maintain it at a distance. Mm. If you know what I mean.
But a nice bloke.
Yeah. Good, a genuinely good bloke. Mm. I see a lot of the traits that I have in me now, I see in him, or I did see in him. His temper was one of them. He was notorious for having I was never on the receiving end of it. He never raised a hand to me in my life, but he had a real short temper, like 0 to 100 in like a split second. And I had that. I still have it a little bit, but nowhere near as bad as I used to have. I think the past few years I've learned to get in check with your emotions and deal with them and manage them a lot better than just flying off the handle.
Do you see other traits that you had in your parents and values and things like that? Do you see that now? You know, the more you reflect and you understand.
As I'm getting older again, I often reflect to myself if I'm questioning things. I was like, what would my old man do in this situation? And I still say it to this day, like, how would my old man figure this? How would he square this circle? So I do see a lot of... And, looking back now, as he got older, that temper thing, he got rid of that, and he very, very quickly became a far more empathetic, far more sort of forgiving, embracing sort of person. And I think working abroad as well, it affected him because you have a language barrier that you have to overcome. So you need to be a lot more deliberate the way you speak. You have to be a lot more engaging in the way you communicate. So I think that's where he got that real sort of... He sort of got a second wind in his life when he moved to France. He became like a sort of like a semi-retired party animal. He became like the life and soul of most office parties. I think they always have like a big annual carnival in France in Dunkirk where he stayed, and his house was right on the promenade, right on the beach, and he had quite a big gaff, and it was a focal point for bagpipe playing and all sorts of nonsense. But yeah,
was he Scottish as well? Did he have a broad accent?
Yeah. He was a big typical. The only thing he was missing was the ginger hair and the ginger beard. He was a big barrel chested, big, just a big jock, just a big lovable guy. Yeah. He would have suited just a big one of those CU Jimmy hats with the red hair and the beard, because he was just classically just a big happy friendly dude.
You did A levels and then went to uni.
Yeah, I went to uni for 2 years.
You said you weren't academic earlier on, but what?
I wasn't really, but it got to the stage that when you leave school, people start asking you questions like, what do you want to do now? And I thought to myself, well, that's a pretty good question. I probably should have asked myself that 4 or 5 years ago. But so I quickly had to think on my feet and think, so, you know, what can I turn my hand to? What would I like to do? What would I want to do? And again, still being, had my toe firmly in the sort of health and fitness aspect of life, started learning a lot more about nutrition and training and all that sort of thing. So, I looked at doing that as a sort of profession, so I went to Strathclyde University for 2 years and studied sports and exercise science. Which, when I told my father that I was going to uni to study health and fitness, he was like, "Why don't you not get a real job, son?" You know, looked at one of those job prospects that you just get a raised eyebrow from. But it was what I wanted to do, and I liked the idea of maybe being in tracksuit for the rest of my working career. So. Yeah, so I followed that path for 2 years. And again, it wasn't particularly challenging, but again, it wasn't particularly rewarding. It was one of those things. I found university was going to be a case of, if you want to benefit from this and you want to gain from this, you have to commit 4 to 6 years of your time in your life to really get a fundamental knowledge and grounding and understanding to be able to take that into the working world. And again, looking at me and my my academic qualifications and abilities, I was like, if I'm going to have to apply myself for 6 years, it's a big gamble, because I don't know if I've got the endurance for 6 years of this, 6 years of academia. It was a bit of a big task. So that's when I started looking at, right, I like being fit, I like health and fitness, what else could I do? you know, what other avenues would be available to me. And that's when I thought about the military. You know, somebody said to me, you know, why don't you join the military as a physical training instructor? And that sort of set off a little light bulb in the back of my head, thinking that might not be a bad idea. And of course, when I mentioned it to all my friends and peers, they were like, you are never going to figure out the army. Because again, I was beginning to develop that little bit of a temper that I got from my dad, and I was a little bit of a hothead. And all my friends were like, there is no way you're going to be able to tolerate somebody shouting and swearing at you, telling you what to do, when to do it, and for how long. But for some reason, I thought to myself, I don't think so. I think I would be able to, I think I'd fit right in, to be honest.
Mm.
I mean, I was still quite young, but I thought I was mature for my years. So I thought, you know, all that shouting and swearing that you imagine from army training, I thought I would just be able to look beyond that and look past that and look at the sort of the long game, what the end state would be. And it turned out to be the case. You know, I fitted into the military really, really well.
So you're 21 when you joined.
Yeah, yeah.
In 2001. What was the difference then? So you joined, was you the oldest? Was you like middle?
I think there was one other guy who was younger than me by a couple of years, but essentially I was the oldest dude by far. There was a majority of them were 16, 17 year olds, you know. It was a culture shock. Yeah, it was a real culture shock. But again, having that little bit of more maturity, having a little bit more life experience, again, it set me up for a lot more success, because the shock of capture, you know, of the first couple of weeks of being in military training wasn't as profound, or I didn't notice it as much as the kids left and right of me did, because, you know, the second or third night there, and there's a queue of people with like their letter that they've written that I want to leave. So but again, I think I fitted in quite well, but I knew what to expect, to be honest. And I, being a couple of years older, I think it just that little bit more level of maturity to just see beyond the, you know, the shouting and the swearing.
Had you lived away at uni?
No, I lived at home.
So you still lived at home?
Yeah, because I was from Falkirk to Glasgow. It was only 20, 25 minutes on the train, so right. I used to commute.
So it was still the first time away from home, prolonged?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then what did you join?
So I joined the Argyll and Southern Highlanders, which is one of the five Scottish infantry battalions. In the amalgamation in 2006, it became five Scots. But when I joined, it was the Argyll and Southern Highlanders.
But why the infantry?
Again, well, it was something I figured I'd turn my hand to. Before I joined that, I was in the Royal Marines briefly, and I badly injured my back, sort of like week six, week eight, I think it was. And because it was a lower back injury, I was told I was going to be sort of confined to camp until it was effectively managed, because they obviously had a duty of care to look after me. So the prospect of sitting in Limpston for 6 months, being 500 miles away from my home and my family, it was quite a daunting task. So I decided to leave there and then, and if I wanted to come back and try again, I would do so. I eventually got home, got my back fixed, and then the choice was, do I go back and roll all the way back through Royal Marines selection and do all that stuff again, or do I have a look at the army because it might be potentially a little bit easier? So I took that avenue. But when in the military careers office, when they heard that I'd been and done this, they were like, this shouldn't be a problem for you. So I was pretty much sort of fast tracked down the line, and it didn't take long, to be honest.
Mm.
I think it took two or three months to get me in the door.
So past training, where did you got to your regiment? Yeah. Battalion, sorry.
So I joined them in Belfast for the last year and a half of a 3 year tour. So they were the resident infantry battalion based in Holyrood Barracks. So again, it was a, they were the public order battalion, so all the public order incidents, all the riots, all that sort of jazz, we got heavily involved in. So it was just a year and a half of public order training. There was an op cycle, so you did a month worth of guard, a month's worth of training, then a month's worth of being on operational deployment down at a camp called Girdwood, right in the middle of Belfast city centre. So it was the first year and a half of my career. So there wasn't a great deal else to do, because when you were in Belfast, you were quite sort of you weren't gated as such, but there was a lot of control measures of where you could go. There was a lot of out of bounds places you had to check out of bounds lists before you would leave camp to find out, you know, if an area that was in bounds was now out of bounds, and so on and so forth. A lot of guys, you know, started relationships with chicks over there. Some of them turned out to be, you know, not as legitimate as they first made out, and there was a couple of incidents where, you know, there's couple of security compromises through, you know, guys just saying the wrong things to the wrong females who then know the wrong people. And yeah.
The job role itself, though, you know, for a young, strong man who'd been playing rugby for years, that sounds like a good role to have.
I mean, I think when you first do the pre-deployment training before you get to Belfast, you do all the public order stuff. It's actually quite a good laugh, and it's definitely a different experience being in a baseline in North Belfast with people throwing petrol bombs at you and spitting at you. It was interesting, but not. Again, oddly enough, but not enjoyable. It was actually quite a good time. Quite a good time.
You went to Iraq 2003. You did Telic 2, so it was after the war.
Yeah,
kind of like the clean up or whatever you want to call it. Enjoy that?
Not really. It wasn't a good. I mean, but this time we'd left Belfast and we'd moved to Canterbury. We'd now joined part of 16 Air Assault Brigade. So there was us, two para, three para, and one Royal Irish that made up 16 Air Assault Brigade. And from the sort of taskings then sort of disseminated down. So the more, you know, the more capable battalions got the better jobs. Maybe they considered the less capable or the less, you know, the less well-established battalions got the less Gucci jobs, for want of a better word. So I think we went out there and we were training the ICDC, which is the Iraqi Civil Defence Force. And it was basically taking these guys who just did not have a clue what they were doing, did not want to be there. Somebody just giving them a uniform, a baseball cap, and an AK-47, and then you were trying to teach them just, you know, the real most low level basics of camp security, searching people, vehicle searching, challenging people. Just it was real. It was just to try and fundamentally set the conditions for them to reestablish some sort of infrastructure in the country with regards to security forces and how they were governing themselves. Because I think at the time it was probably still is such a corrupt country. But that was our glamorous task, and was to train these guys.
So you came back from Iraq. Then, I mean, speaking before, you went to Bosnia in 2005.
Yeah, we had a real strange task. Again, I don't know where this came from. It was everyone looked left and right and went, what's going on? So we went to Bosnia and did a 6-month tour there. Again, it was just our battalion based in Banja Luka, a metal factory. Company groups scattered all over the country. And it was aimed at a lot of low-level sort of organised crime stuff that was going on in Bosnia at the time. It was a real strange task. Nobody could really get their head around why we were going and what the fundamentals of the actual tasking was. But like I say, there was a lot of low-level crime, a lot of illegal logging was going on. And I remember when we were hearing this going, we surely can't be deploying for 6 months to go and tackle a bunch of illegal Bosnian lumberjacks that are dealing in sort of, you know, contraband timber. It was, but thankfully I wasn't there too long. I think I did 2 or 3 months, and I was coming back because I had a bunch of career courses that I'd managed to jack up back to back to back. So I'd managed to arrange it. So I did my NCO's CARA. Then 2 weeks later than that, there was a pre-junior Brecon course started. I got myself loaded onto that. And if I passed the pre-junior course, I was going straight up to junior Brecon. So within that summer, I managed to get myself back from Bosnia. And within that summer, I went from private soldier to qualified full screw in the space of almost one summer.
All right, so junior Brecon as a career course.
Yeah.
You go to the Brecon Beacons, and you go to the infantry, the battle school?
Yeah, the infantry battle school in Brecon.
And then that's where you do an arduous and fairly long career development course.
It's long. It's split into two halves. So the first half is skill at arms, which is 12 weeks long. You're learning how to give recruits weapons lessons, teaching them, you know, all the different weapon systems, all the safety points, all the do's, all the don'ts. So you do that for 12 weeks, and then the next 12 weeks is a tactics phase, which is pretty much, as the name suggests, it's out in the field pretty much Monday to Thursday night all week, doing all your teaching. All the teaching phases got phased out from the classroom, so all the teaching gets done in the field. So it's a long old course. So I think I started that in July, and then I eventually got home in November. So it's a long old time.
Was you good? Was you a good soldier?
Yeah, but this time I was beginning to growing into myself as a soldier, because the first year and a half when I joined the battalion, fortunately we were in Belfast and we weren't doing much. But I managed to blow out one of the ligaments in my knee, so I was sidelined for the first sort of year and a half because I hit the battalion with I hit the ground running. I had quite a good report from training and whatnot, and And yet, no sooner had I landed than I blew out one of the ligaments in my knee. So that sidelined me for about a year and a half. So I found myself in what was considered one of the most disrespected jobs in any battalion, which was the regimental police. So So I got, because I couldn't do anything. I had to get an operation on my knee. So I got sidelined with the caveat that you were promoted to Lance Corporal. And I was like, brilliant, but I'm one of the most hated guys in the battalion. So the onus was on me to get out, get myself fit, get myself promoted, and get myself out of that job. So I really applied myself, and by the end of junior Brecon, I was pretty competent and pretty capable.
I'm ready to go. You know, I was speaking to my brother the other day about the 90s and doing Bosnias. When he did a couple of Bosnias in the 90s, and he was saying, I was drinking Stella every night, and it was, you know, and I put loads of weight on, and it was like carnage in Bosnia. And you mentioned Bosnia 2005, and we also mentioned the kind of 2000 tours where it was dry and it was arduous, and you went into a volatile situation. You went to Afghan in 2007.
Yeah.
What was the role there?
We were Kabul Force Protection Group, so there's a main camp that was based in just on the outskirts of Kabul along the Jalalabad Road called Camp Suter, and it sort of backed onto Kabul International Airport. So that was the main camp where the Force Protection Group was based. It was always a company group, so we took over from, it was 4-2 Commando, I forget the company group, but we took over from them for a six-month tour of Kabul. And like the name suggests, you're essentially the Force Protection. So it's a lot of sedentary, a lot of, you know, rudimentary patrols, a lot of, you know,
in the city,
yeah, in the city and the surrounding areas of the city. But Kabul itself is quite a built up, so it's quite a concentrated city. So you were really restricted as to where you could go, because a lot of the patrols were mounted, so you were mounted in vehicles. So a lot of it you were restricted as to what you could do. So, but the intention was to just establish and maintain a big enough footprint as possible in and around the city. So that was the job. Again, it wasn't that glamorous. It was. If you weren't on guard, you were training. If you weren't training, you were on patrol. So it was the cycle was pretty basic, to be honest. Yeah,
It was dangerous.
Again, it depends how you look at it. You could look at Kabul and say, you know, it's a heavily populated city. You know, there's a massive demographic, blah, 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 blah. And you could look at, you know, as it is, there's a lot going on under the radar. And I obviously know this from working there privately, you know, later on in life, but there's a lot that goes on under the radar that you don't really notice about. And I think complacency in a place where you're not hearing things go bang every day, complacency can be a killer. We found out later on in the tour. We'd had a really quiet tour, but we're about 4 months into it. And we'd had a lot of success with the company commander at the time was doing a lot of hearts and minds stuff. There was a bunch of schools in the area that we were doing, you know, a lot of work with schools, getting building work done in the schools, a lot of infrastructure put in at schools. And he was making the headlines, sort of, I say the headlines, but he was quite vocal in his voice, you know, saying that we're trying to do this, we're trying to do that, we're investing money here. And the irony was that we were out doing the last of what was a resupply run to a high school specifically for girls in the north of the city. We're taking them just a whole bunch of resources for, was it cold weather jackets and clothes to footballs to pens and pencils, you know, basic stuff that you need to establish a school. And I think we just dropped off the last of the run. So we're essentially coming through the centre of the city, coming back down to the Jalalabad Road and heading east out of the city back down towards Camp Suter. And within being on that road, within 5 minutes, we got hit by a suicide bomber and two of the vehicles in our patrol were taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was picked up, and looking back in hindsight, we now know how it happened, and we were being completely and utterly dicked the entire time over the partner life, the schools that we were visiting, you know, the way that we were documenting what we were doing, how we were going to try and, you know, give these schools the infrastructure and the what they need to try and establish some sort of, you know, a future for the girls of the area. They caught on to the fact that we were doing all these resupply runs. We were doing the same route at the same time. And they set us up.
Was it a vehicle or was it an individual?
Yeah, it was a vehicle. So it was a Toyota Hilux, a 4x4, just packed out with explosives. We were going down the Jalalabad Road. I was in the second vehicle in. Snatch was the lead vehicle. I was in a Saxon. There was a Snatch behind me. And from a side road, we just saw a Toyota Hilux just pull onto the road, you know, wobbling all over the place, you know, erratic driving. But if you've been to Kabul, you'll know, or any sort of city like that, you'll know that people just get a driving license in a box of cereal, mate. If you're tall enough to reach the pedals, you're tall enough to drive. So erratic driving is not something that would normally raise, you know, a red flag. But he came out of the side street and made an attempt for the first vehicle. He banged into him. That sent sort of the snatch vehicle careering to the left. And as they kind of came together, they separated by the force, but almost like they circled away from each other and then came back together and hit each other. And as they hit, the guy detonated his device and caused a huge, huge explosion. Killed one of the guys that was on top cover, badly injured the other guy on top cover.
We say top cover, you mean you're in the back of the vehicle, poking out
standing
the top
up,
with a rifle.
Out of hatch, rifle.
No protection, no armour protection.
Nah, nothing like that. So, we were eventually found post-mortem what had happened to him, and actually he'd been hit underneath the armor line on his Osprey body armor. And we were trying to figure out how it had happened, and because at the time he was leaning out of his top cover hatch in such a way to try and, because he was going to engage the driver of the vehicle, but he had to lean right out of the hatch to get an angle to shoot this guy, and he'd obviously just exposed his body too much, and when the device had detonated. He caught a huge bit of fragment right up the inside of his body armor line, almost chopped him in half.
And injuries as well.
Yeah. There was another guy who was in the top cover with him. He had really, really bad blast injuries to his face. He got a huge, big bit of shrapnel through his hand that almost separated, sort of down in between his thumb, sort of his ring finger and his middle finger, almost separated right down at the sort of the cuff. Mm. A really, really bad hand injury. A couple of guys got sort of just little fragmentation injuries and stuff like that, but yeah.
What was the Kazevac? What was it?
Again, this was there's certain things that when you look back in your military career, your either your bum clenches tightly or your toes curl. This is a toe curler for me, was the Kazevac procedure. So again, you can rehearse until it goes bang and everyone's got to react. It's you can never know what's going to happen. So yeah, it was a case of inexperiencedness on the ground, an incident that nobody had ever seen or dealt with before, the shock of it all happening, a very, very, very inexperienced QRF medical QRF unit that came out to conduct the Kazevac. He was dead by the time we got him down from top cover, mate. It was obvious he was totally unresponsive, but it didn't take away from the fact that the people that were coming out to sort of to administer the help, administer the Kazevac procedure, it was disjointed to say. That's probably being as respectful as it could be. It was incredibly disjointed.
Coming back off that tour, were you married at this point?
Yeah. I got married before, just as I joined the army, I got married. So yeah. I'm 21 year old, I got married. I was quite young.
And relationship good at this point?
All still good, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, my missus, her dad was in the army for 22 years, so she was a pad brat, so she kind of, she knew the lifestyle. But she was she's a very headstrong individual woman, so she wasn't a sort of classic pad's wife who, you know.
Yeah, not to disrespect pad's wives, she wasn't dependent on you.
She wanted to make her own career. She wasn't the wife of private or such and such. She was her own individual, so she worked for Canterbury University. She studied when we were in Canterbury. And she worked for the university at the same time.
Mm.
So she always has been an incredibly headstrong woman. So she just does her own thing.
You came back. So after that tour, came back, did a bit of career development, bit of instructing. Afghan again in Herrick 14 in 2011.
Herrick 13, 2011.
Pardon, sorry. 13 in 2011. And I'm going to ask you two questions. How would the situation changed in regards to threat and the feeling, especially in your situation, moving from Kabul? And then answer that first, if you would.
Please. I think the threat from moving from any sort of city out to the more rural elements of Helmand, the threat is so different. The hardest thing to do is to positively identify who's firing at you. I'd argue the fact with anyone, when you're being shot at, to try and find out who it is and where they are is almost impossible. So
The risk increased. Was it more kinetic? Was it more? Was it more soldiering? Was it more what you expect? Not just a 4 month tour of nothing and then one.
Yeah. It was a lot more. But the point I was trying to make is because the rules had changed so much. The rules of engagement, the terms of how you could open fire and what you could do to protect yourself had changed massively because I wasn't in the early. I didn't do the early Hellman tours, but you know, there was, I know guys that were down there that was like rocks drift, it was shoot first and ask questions later. Whereas now it was very, very apparent before we even deployed and pleaded pre-deployment training, just how much emphasis they were putting on positively identifying your target. You have to think before you can shoot and all this sort of thing. And I consciously remember everyone questioning the ability to be able to open fire and protect yourself because there was such an emphasis being put on positively identifying your target, collateral damage, all that sort of thing, hearts and minds. I think the US commander was General McChrystal at the time. I think it was McChrystal. And he was a massive counterinsurgency, scholar. And he was coming up with the mainframe as to how we were going to do this counterinsurgency ops. And it was all about winning over the hearts and minds of the population, which, I 100% agree. But when those terms and conditions are stopping you from protecting yourself and protecting those around you when you're being shot at, it sounded like a tough deal. Do you know what I mean? Mm. You're being sent out there to go and to patrol, to dominate the ground, to have an influence over the people of that area. But if somebody shoots at you, you've got to ask two or three questions and do a tiny little assessment in your head before you can even return one round. Mm. And it was, and for me, for experienced soldiers, it was like, yeah, I'll be able to make that decision on the ground. But if you're an inexperienced private soldier, this is your first tour of Afghanistan, and you're reluctant to do what you've been trained to do and told to do purely because there's rules and there's regulations, and which I totally understand they have to be there for a number of reasons, but there was a lot of questions being asked. Can I do this? Can I do that? Should I do this? And it's such a negative attitude to have going out on the ground. You should be going out on the ground, completely capable in your own ability and what you're able to do. Yeah, it was strange. The situation had definitely changed. You had to be a lot more careful. Even dropping ordnance, you had to go all the way back through three or four different radio systems back to Bastion to get a two-star general's authorization to drop ordnance or fire mortars. Or everything took so much longer. And in the space of a contact, which can last from seconds to minutes, when you're trying to get clearance to drop ordnance or to do anything, and it's just time wasted.
Had you lost trust in it, did you still trust, or was it been affected? Was the leadership been affected? Was the communication?
I think commanders at a certain level felt a little bit confined a little bit. I think the higher level commanders felt their hands were tied slightly because they're essentially making the pivotal decisions. The junior commanders are the sort of the core face of the kinetic activity. You can't second guess their decision making because if you're at the point of contact, your decision making or the decisions you make have to be the right ones. You can't second guess your own questions. But I think the higher echelons of command were. They felt their hands were tied slightly. I know my boss did as well. Because when we went out there on Herrick 13, we had an ITV film crew come with us as well. Geraint and Vincent came out with us for a couple of stints, and he was very, very conscious of it as well. And I remember him speaking to our company commander about it, about how he felt that your hands were being tied slightly. Commanders were having to sit on their hands, and they could be less effective in the battle and less effective in what they wanted to do. Purely because the ROE and the authorization or the clearance required to do anything or to drop anything was three or four extra hoops to jump through.
Yeah, I mean, you were patrolling a lot. The question I was going to ask is how the role had changed, but I'm going to kind of bypass that and say, your role patrolling, but were you getting engaged? Was things happening? Because you mentioned your hands being tied, but was this happening once or twice, or was it happening day after day? How was it?
We had like a safe space around the patrol base that we were in. So we had like a sort of kilometre safe bubble around it. But there was a village to the north of us called Saidabad Calais. It was roughly about a kilometre as the crow flies, and that was a hotbed. That was always the first area we would ever be shot at from. So there was a few operations that we would put in place to try and prompt a little bit of activity out there. And this is one way that the role had changed, and you could actively plan a kinetic operation, and you could actually go and action it. And there would be the resources in the back end to do it. For instance, a task that we did quite often was called Op Archer. So this village that I'm talking about, Saidabad Calais, within small arms range of it was about 300 metres. There was a big prominent wadi that used to go across this big irrigation field. And if you got to that wadi, you could expect to get shot at within 1 or 2 minutes. And it was usually always the case. So we started doing these operations. It was either my call sign or another call sign, who was nicknamed the Tethered Goat. So they'd essentially send us up to this wadi as the Tethered Goat to prompt some sort of kinetic response from the village. It usually always happened. When this is happening, we usually have one or two other call signs that are on the ground going flanking left or flanking right around the village itself. At the same time, we've got an Apache up in the overhead, standing off maybe 10 or 15 kilometres, and you've got a JTAC on the ground speaking to him, bringing him onto the targets of all these all the compounds in the village. We had quite success dropping a bunch of ordnance, doing that sort of thing, drawing the fire from the firing points, and then dropping ordnance from a helicopter that was standing way off.
Mm. Did you enjoy it, Afghan?
Yeah, great fun, mate. It really, really was. Really was. Again, a couple of squeaky bum moments, but I think everyone's probably got a couple of those.
Mm. Less toe curling. More squeaky bum.
Yeah, let's talk about some definite squeaky bum moments, definitely.
As a battalion and as the group you were with, was you slick? Were you systemised? Did you have procedures? Was it?
We got better. I think as we joined 16 Air Assault Brigade, we had to grow into our skin because we were working alongside units that had real belief in themselves and real ethos that we didn't have. Parachute Regiment are great for it, mate. You know, their own self-belief and their own ethos, it's what fuels it, you know, it's what fuels them. We didn't have that in the first instance. I think as the Afghan campaign began to grow, I think if you were a soldier across the board, you had to sort of grow into your skin and you had to consider yourself a professional in doing what you do. And I know I certainly didn't, a lot of the guys took their job really, really seriously. So the emphasis was on everyone to be as slick and as smooth as possible. To train again, to make sure that you were well drilled and well versed, and it became like people took pride in their ability to be a good smooth operator rather than the guy that's just always in shit state because everyone knows them because we've all seen them and we've all got them.
So, but you were thriving, you enjoyed it. You came back from Afghan, you did another big career course that you excelled at, You got distinction with it.
Yeah.
Senior Brecken. But why did you sign off?
I think me and a bunch of guys in my sort of demographic were looking left and right and going, the Afghan campaign is definitely closing down. I mean, Herrick 13, I think, was the last sort of, 13 and 14 were the last sort of kinetic tours. After that, it's really started to drop off. So personally, I was thinking to myself, well, what am I going to do? What's the next 3 or 4 years going to look like for me? As a platoon sergeant, what am I going to do? I'm going to stay here. Didn't want to go back to the depot and instruct recruits as a platoon sergeant. I definitely didn't want to do that because that's just a bigger headache than being a section commander as an instructor. The battalion was going back heavily onto a training cycle. There was talk of our battalion being disbanded as well because the defence cuts came around. One of the Scottish battalion was going to go. And it was rumoured it was going to be us because we were part of 16 Air Assault Brigade, which had a bigger price tag attached to it than the other operational commitments of the other Scottish battalions. So everyone, the jungle drums were rumbling in the distance, and I'm thinking to myself, do I want to jump or be pushed? I thought I'd rather jump. So, I'd always sort of been thinking about doing something else in the CP world, sort of. It opened itself up to me. I mean, it was something I thought I'd be able to do, I'd be able to turn my hand at. I'd always been quite good at, tactics. I'd always been,
close protection.
I'd always been, I considered myself a good operator. And I think there was no reason I couldn't take those skills and transfer them across to Civvy Street. So, yeah, much to the disapproval of my commanding officer, the same day that I got a distinction on senior brick, and was the same day I terminated my term of service with the British Army. So that didn't go down too well. And I was made to suffer the consequences for the next 9 months until I got out. But I took the resettlement money that the military offer you and put it to good use. I went and did the G4S Secure Solutions Close Protection course, which is run up at Hereford by a bunch of ex-Hereford guys. Really, really good course. 4 weeks course. Ran really well, ran really professionally, ran by guys that have got, you know, huge subject matter knowledge, done, you know, VIP protection, royal protection. So gave a real good grounding of what the job was. And it was a bonus because the G4S Secure Solutions, you got a job interview at the end of the course. So that was maybe probably the price tag that was attached to the course was so big. It was an expensive course, but the caveat was you got a job interview at the end of it. Mm-hmm. So me and another guy did really well on the course. We both got a distinction on it. So we both got sort of winked at the end of the course and said, just be on standby.
So you did 4 years, or pretty much 4 years,
yeah,
doing close protection, back to Afghan, coming various stints away,
yeah,
different weeks, months away, coming back.
Yeah, it was a pretty organised life, to be honest. That was one good thing about it. You were set on a cycle. You did 9 weeks in country, and then you did 3 weeks back at home. So you could plan ahead, you know, months or years in advance, because you knew roughly where you were going to be on that cycle. So
And stable family life, still stable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, really wife stable. Still. You know,
yeah.
Things good.
Everything's good. Yeah, everything's.
Tell
good.
Me about the car accident in 2016.
Something completely and utterly, you know, not even a massive incident, but again, driving B6 armored vehicles, there's a lot of weight behind these things. And again, people in Kabul, they have no sense or no understanding or no knowledge of how to drive and where to drive and what's right and what's wrong. Again, if you can reach the pedals of a car, you're old enough to drive. So, the road system, the road network is just, it doesn't lend itself to, you know, safe driving. So yeah, we got hit up, we got primed in a bad car accident. Me and another guy got pretty badly twisted up. So I got CASA. They have a rule. You have 72 hours from declaring yourself unfit to declare yourself fit again, because you're in a country that's, you know, it's a high threat this country. Your job as a CP guy, you're not just a CP operator. When you're back in the camp, you're part of the QRF for the camp defence and all that sort of thing. So they need to have people in place to have an operational commitment. You need to have X amount of operators on the ground. So you've got 3 days to produce yourself fit for work again, or they send you home.
It's a company as well, is it?
Yeah.
You know, a for-profit.
Yeah, exactly.
Company. It's not a very, charity.
It's a very profitable company as well. So yeah, you're a number. If you're not fit, then you need to leave.
And so what did you do with your back?
I turned out eventually through a process of elimination and months and thousands of pounds of scans. I got two herniated discs in my lumbar spine, my L4 and my L5. Are both herniated. There's a fracture in one of them as well. So, yeah, I've got pretty compounded back injuries, and it sidelined me for a long time. I had the added benefit of G4S. They send you home on a slightly reduced salary, and that sort of acts as your insurance money to keep you ticking over, so you can pay for your bills and all the monthly outgoings. But you're sort of the onus is on yourself to get yourself back up and running, back in fully fitness. If you want your job back, the onus is firmly on you. So I tried everything I could to get myself back into working order, but I don't know if it's just, I must just come from really bad peasant stock and put together badly. Injuries have plagued me my entire life, mate, all through the military as well. I've always had something wrong with me. I have to come off selection courses because this is when this knee's went, and this is, you know, I must just come from.
And this was different though, because you were at home, not employed as such. You weren't part of the team anymore.
No.
The purpose was to get fit again, but it was taking time.
Yeah.
And so were you in London?
Yeah.
House? Well,
yeah, yeah.
So you was in your house in London.
Yeah.
Was your wife working?
Yeah, yeah. She's working over
here. So what was you doing day to day?
Day to day, again, I was getting up. I was doing stretching. I was taking myself to the gym. I was trying to keep myself. I found I had to get out of the house and put myself in the gym setting was the best place to do it, because at least I felt like I was physically, I was in the right place to do what I needed to do to get my body better. Being in the gym, just mentally, I felt like it was the right place to be.
A good environment.
But again, there's only so much rehab you can do it yourself of a day, every day. So a lot of that time I was going back to the house. I was spending a lot of time sitting in the house on my own, a lot of time thinking about what if this doesn't get better? What if I can't do this? I found myself getting into a real negative way of thinking really quickly. Instead of going, right, how can I fix this? I'm just like, right, how am I going to be able to live with this problem, this affliction? So, and again, looking back, and I can see how it happened quite quickly. I got myself into a real negative headspace of always thinking on the along the negative lines of what I'm not going to be able to do rather than what I might still be able to do. And that just there, and that started to really get a grip on me quite considerably.
So your physical health was damaged. Your mental health was deteriorating.
Yeah.
Because of the physical impact.
But
also, sorry, I'm not going to put words into your mouth, but did you feel that you were contributing?
No. That was one thing. I'd lost that sense of belongingness that I didn't realize I needed, but on the flip side, I did really need that you know, camaraderie, you know, just having a group, a good group of people beside you that you know that you can trust, you can believe in, you can rely on. I didn't have any of that. And what I found that I was consciously doing is I was pushing people away as well. There was people that were trying to maintain a relationship, trying to find out how are things going? Can we do anything from where we're at? Can we help you? And I was just pushing people away going, nah, I'm fine. I'm figuring it out myself. Because I don't really know why, but I just felt like it was my own problem. I had to deal with it. And instead of encouraging help from those that wanted to help me, I was actually just pushing them away.
Sorry, I mean, you may have just said, was that getting worse?
Yeah.
Or was it spiraling and becoming a bigger issue?
Again, and I was noticed that my temper was getting out of control. I'm so quick to just snap. Because a lot of it was just sheer frustration more than anything else. Sheer frustration that I had the job that I wanted. Everything was, the wheels were in motion. All I had to do was just keep doing what I was doing, and life would have been good. And the frustration of having that just pulled out from underneath your feet in such a non-event as well, just a bump in a car. And the way it had a snowball effect, like a deck of cards, like a house of cards. Everything just started to come down.
Did you have good people around you? I know you just mentioned there, was there friends nearby, or was you part of a group? You went to the gym, was it a solo effort?
A lot of it was. The gym thing for me was always a solo effort. I was never a training buddy. I was never, come and spot me, bro. I was never one of those guys. Always, leave me alone, headphones in, don't talk to me. And again, being down in London, having left the military, I'd sort of left all my military friends behind. So the only way I was kind of staying in touch with them is through social media or Facebook. Again, all my other friends were in Kabul or they were in Iraq working at the embassies. So I had nobody around me because we just prior to me getting sent home from Kabul, we'd moved house from Canterbury to Dartford, where we stay just now. So we'd moved to a brand new area, which was going to benefit my wife for her work. But the downside of that is I knew absolutely no one in Dartford. I moved to a completely new place and didn't have any connections there whatsoever.
It's almost a perfect storm, really, for deteriorating psychologically.
Yeah,
I've said this before on here. When I left the military, and I was younger than you when I left, but I left and then immediately joined a rugby league club.
Yeah.
So I had it back again.
Yeah.
You know, two of my best mates now are those guys then. And I had that team, I had that.
Yeah.
The contact, physical contact. Yeah. I had all that aggression out there. I'd banter, all that kind of good stuff.
And you pay lip service to it, but see, when you don't have it, it means so much. It's so fundamentally important. If I hadn't pushed away all the people that were trying to just, I mean, they weren't being overt in their help with me. They were just, you know, if you need to talk, I'm here. You know, just giving you sort of the lowest level of encouragement. But I was hearing it completely different. I was like, I don't need your help. I don't want your help. I'm just, I'll figure this out myself. And I knew I was doing it because I was really beginning to start thinking really, really negatively. And I think I remember doing it. There was a conscious moment where I thought to myself, you know what, if this doesn't get any better, I'll just fucking kill myself. And when I said it, I remember thinking it, I was like, it's a pretty profound thing to say, but I never ever considered it as an option, but I was getting so tired, mate, and it's just, and I can see what I was doing to everyone else. And that was bothering me as well, because I was just so unpleasant to be around, mate. I was trying to figure a way out of a hole that I was digging myself further and further into. And there was just no way out of it. There was a job options came off for me here and there, a couple of, you know, get rich quick schemes in Dubai and doing some training jobs. And I took a bit of a risk trying to take this job, thinking it would pay off, and it didn't pay off. And again, that was, you know, the shock of that not coming off sent me even further down to down the pit that I was in. And it got to a stage, mate, I had no other options left. By this time, my missus is pretty much done with me. I just put her through the ringer in so many different ways, mate, emotionally. Just, you know, I'm so much of an effort to be around, or I was so much of an effort to be around. It was like, it was energy draining for her to just even be in my company.
Did you feel less of a man?
Yeah, definitely less of a man, and angry for it as well, and maybe taking it out on her a lot. She's never physically, mate, but, mate, it's a real, real bad tongue, you know, a real sharp tongue, as my old man used to say. A real sharp tongue, come out with some real nasty, some real venomous, really hurtful things. Not meaning it, just in the spur of an argument, just completely fly off the handle, mate. Completely irrational behaviour.
Summer 2018, you talk about the suicide attempt.
Yeah, it was a long time coming. I'd given myself a couple of times before. I would think to myself, give it another week, give it another week. And then the irony was that I did it on a Sunday, and the Monday, the day after, I was meant to be going back and starting a new job back in the prison service. And I knew that I just didn't want to go back in and do that. I just knew that Sunday was going to be the day. So the day beforehand, I was working. I used to run the security at a big nightclub in Greenwich. Really sort of, you know, a big 4,000, 5,000 capacity nightclub. It's open for 12 hours. A real strong drug culture runs through the whole club. So again, you're searching people all the time. You finish the work with like a pocket full of pills every night. And I remember consciously keeping a handful of them aside, not putting them in the amnesty box and saying, I'm going to keep hold of these because I'm going to need these, you know, tomorrow afternoon, tomorrow evening, whenever it is, just to get me into a happy place. Just, I was planning it that far in advance that I knew that night I went to work, I needed to sort of get a couple of those just to put me in a happy place for the following day, just to get me in a bit more of a relaxed state so I could do what by now I have every single intention of doing. So I came home from work that morning about 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. I think Cassie was out at the time. She was doing her own thing, trying to stay away from me. And I was banging around the house like a bear with a sore head for a couple of hours. She eventually came back in. And by this time I knew in my head that I was going to do it. And I was sort of almost like showing off in front of her, like almost goading her a little bit, going, are you sure you don't want to talk to me? Are you sure we don't want to sort this out? Because you might not get another chance. You know what? I was being really spiteful in the way that I was talking to her.
Threatening.
Yeah, almost. Because she didn't know what my intentions were, but I knew what they were, quite clearly. So, yeah, she eventually left. She's like, I can't deal with you. I'm leaving. Just do what you want. Just do your thing. And that was me. That was a green light. I think that was the last. That was my last ditch effort. I think I was wanting her to grab a hold of me and do something, say, you know, stop. But I pushed her so far away from me, mate. She was just, there was no way she was going to do that. She was just like, please just get away from me. Please just give me space. You need your space. I need my space. Just leave me alone. So I thought, this is the best time. So I made all the preparations, took myself into the spare room, barricaded myself in the spare room, wrote a letter, very, very cold and to the point. I think it was something like, it was very, very clinical. It was something like, my name is Stephen Japp. I'm 37 years old. And for me, this is 37 years too many or something like that. Then I just went into a bit of a sort of rant as to, you know, what should happen to the house. Cassie, she should be all right. It's, everything goes to her. It was very sort of cold and to the point. It's, I'm me. I no longer have a desire to be here. My wife gets everything to make sure she's okay. And I just signed off. I wrote my best mate, Greg. I text him. I text another one of my mates, just apologising for not being, because I'm really shit at staying in touch with people, really bad at it. And I think I just sent them an apology text to say, I'm sorry I've not been in touch, you know, I'm really bad at it. I do apologise. You're a good friend. And signed off, mate. And yeah, took a couple of tablets to get myself in a happy place, gave it half an hour. And then just, I got the sharpest implement that I could find, mate, and made a real attempt to end my own life. And in the process, turned the spare bedroom into a horror show. Mm. A horror show. It looked like a scene out of a Saw movie. Made a real mess. And the worst thing about it is, I didn't see it through. And the worst thing is that she had to come and she found me. You know, she knew something had happened. She could hear music on in the room or whatever, and she knew something was going on. I wasn't responding, so she ended up breaking down the door, and she found me lying in the bed, right, just clattered everywhere.
Were you conscious? Or?
No, I was unconscious at the time.
Or was you on your way out?
Yeah. But I mean, I'm a real hoarder, and it's a real bad trait. I'm a bit of a military hoarder. So in my bedside cabinet, I've got some real nondescript things that you just have no purpose having in your bedside cabinet. A cat tourniquet is one of them. Don't ask me why. But credit to Cassie, she went and she grabbed that. She put a tourniquet around my arm. She tried to stop the blood flow. She got the ambulance around there. Paramedics came in. I remember regaining consciousness, though, halfway in between her finding me and the paramedics arriving. So they were on their way. I remember my blood pressure must have spiked. And I remember waking back up and conscious of the fact that I was still awake, conscious of the fact that my wrist was now wide open, conscious of the fact that I'd failed and what my intentions were. And this is when I knew that I'd got past the point of no return, because I just picked up the knife that was still sitting on the floor. I just picked up the implement, sorry, that was on the floor, and I just kept going. Mm. I just kept going. Awake, conscious.
With the paramedic and...
No, they weren't here. They were still on their way. But
the fact, Cassie there?
Yeah, she was there.
Was she trying to stop?
Yeah. But I was still trying to go, because I was like, I'm still here. I'm still here. This is not part of the plan. So... yeah, but eventually I lost consciousness again. And then I woke back up. And this is what I remember consciously saying to myself, mate, you have lost your mind. Because I remember waking up, and I don't know if I was trying to communicate or if I was trying to talk, but the noise that was coming out of my body was like, it was a noise I'd never made before. It was like a really sort of high pitch, whimpering and wailing. Like I was trying to get words out, but they weren't coming out. They were just coming out as this really strange noise. And I remember thinking to myself, mate, you have lost your mind. Mm. You have really lost your mind. Yeah, it was a strange experience, in and out of consciousness two or three times. The paramedics got there, they obviously stabilised me. They got me stabilised. I would remember being conscious that they were wheeling me out my apartment. I remember looking at Cassie, she's just crying her eyes out, mate, blood all over her. Just like... yeah, so they blue lighted me to the St. Thomas Hospital, which took maybe 20, 25 minutes. And as I got there was three people waiting for me in casualty from the crisis mental health team. They'd obviously told them the severity of the incident, and it apparently it warranted a response from like the top psychiatrist in Southeast England. So he got pulled out of his Sunday dinner and told to attend St. Thomas Hospital. So, yeah, this team of three people were here, and they sort of guided me through the hospital booking in procedure, and I think they were there just to sort of guide me through the whole
thing. So was you, beg your pardon, so was you conscious now?
Yeah.
They weren't giving you transfusions and...
No, that came later. They managed to stabilise me. They got me into St. Thomas. I remember being awake for this. they introduced me to themselves. We're the mental health crisis team. We're going to now, you know, we're going to be here for you. You're going to go into a surgery. When you come out of surgery, we'll be here. You know, there was a real sort of, they were there to put like a big blanket around you and just say, you know, don't worry, we're here. You're in the right place. You're in the safe place. And just give you all that reassurance that that I suppose people need
to hear. You happy about that?
I can't even remember. I think I was surprised more than anything else. I was like, how do you people know that I'm here? I was impressed more than anything else that from point of wounding an hour and a half ago, there's now three people standing here telling me that I'm going to be okay. I wasn't expecting it, to be honest. I was quite shocked. And I didn't see them again for like another 2 or 3 days because, like I say, I went straight into surgery and I was in and out of surgery for this was Sunday night and I didn't come out of surgery full time and go back up into the ward until Thursday. So I spent 4 days in theatre, in and out of theatre. Three blood transfusions, three surgeries. Yeah.
When in this process, we won't talk about the psychological impact right now, we won't talk about the impact to anyone else, but the physical side of things, you'd really messed your hand up.
Yeah.
The aftermath, let's go to the psychological, you'd agreed and everyone had agreed you were then sectioned for a month.
Yeah.
Where you'd had supervision and I suppose your rights, is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially they remove your sort of decision-making capabilities and they leave the majority of the decisions in the hands of the medical staff that are looking after your welfare. So, yeah, there was two ways that we're going to do it. They were going to section me on the actual mental health wing, which the picture was painted to me and it sounded like, you know, I just had a vision of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with Jack Nicholson in it. I thought that didn't sound like the most conducive environment for recovery from this. So they met me halfway. They said, you can do it in your room, but you're going to have to have a mental health nurse dedicated to you. If 24-hour shift, you can't go anywhere without them. They have to come everywhere with you. So I agreed to that, which on face value, I didn't think it was going to be a big deal. But further down the line, as you're coming to and the dust is clearing and you've got somebody that's always there and sometimes they've not got the best intentions. They just want to get their job done and get home. And yeah, it was having somebody there constantly 24-7 is... It sounds quite reassuring at one point in time. And at one point in time, that would have probably been quite a nice thing for me to hear that there was going to be somebody there with me all the time. But as I started to get a little bit better and the dust began to clear, I was like, I need a little bit of space. You need to let me breathe a little bit. And they're looking at you on face value. You're like, we know what you tried to do 30 days ago. We don't trust you further than we can throw you, mate. You know, because they must see that so often. People telling them one thing to try and reassure them that they're okay, everything's okay. But on the flip side, you know, you don't recover
that quick from a fall that great. And let's just talk about recovery. I mean, your story could be a 3-hour podcast, right? So let's move it a little bit. The aftermath. No, let's talk about the longer term recovery. I suppose like the next couple of years. What you was on medication.
Yeah,
you would become disabled because of your hand.
Yeah.
I mean, very limited movement now in...
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, everything... I mean, if you look at your wrist and you look at all the structures that's in there, there's a key bunch of components going on in there and I compromised pretty much everything that was in there. So, yeah, the function that I have now is next to nothing. It's essentially... my hand is a fist. Everything was cut, so everything was severed, so everything's shorter, so... Yeah, there's not a great deal of a function in it. A mutual friend of ours, though, is now...
We'll get on to that in a sec. Psychologically, the recovery, did you go... And let's try and summarise it as much as we can. Did you go through formal therapy?
Yeah, when I left, it's a handover procedure. So when you leave, I left St Thomas, I got handed over to the local mental health team in my area, who then did a daily visits to the house for the first 2 weeks. They then do a risk assessment on you to see how you are. If they deem you're suitable to be handed over to the next sort of step down in severity, so you go to, from the regional mental health team, you go to the, sort of the local mental health team, and they sort of step you down in order of how severe or what your needs and what your wants are. So they meet your needs with the requirement of the sort of that level of response. But again, I was going through the motions and just telling these people, yeah, I'm good. Because what they were doing for me, I essentially wasn't doing anything. They were there as a point of contact. I had to go down and see them once a week. And when I came out of hospital, I thought, well, these are going to be the people that help me. These people, they're going to dedicate their time to get me through this, to figure out why this has happened, what was the reasons for it, how do I then move forward from it. But actually what they were doing is they were just holding a plaster on a gash, and with no intention of really making it stick or really stopping the blood flow. It was just, you can see the people that are trying to do their best for you, but they know that this is just a short-term fix, because in order for you to get any long-term established mental health treatment, you're going to wait between 6 and 12 months to get seen just for one consultation, to then review your case to see what sort of treatment would be suitable for you.
I think one of the big factors which shocked me but then didn't shock me was the fact that they'd pinned PTSD on you.
Mm-hmm.
When to you it was quite obviously not.
Yeah. I mean, the early stages, the first week of doing the one-to-one work with a psychiatrist in my room, they do a full rewind back to your childhood, and then they start sort of walking forward in slow time, trying to pick up things that they can hang a tag on. So, you know, it was very, very easy for them to say, oh, you were ex-military, oh, you've been in Afghanistan and Iraq and all these places, oh, you've been a close protection operator in Afghanistan. You've clearly seen a lot of, you know, you've been in a lot of situations. You clearly have PTSD. It's the most logical answer. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I don't fundamentally agree with that whatsoever. The time I had in the army was nothing but a positive time. I would go back to Afghanistan in a heartbeat. I really, really thrived in that environment, really thrived in it. What they were telling me to them sounded logical, and it sounded like 1,001 other stories that I'd heard of somebody who'd left the military, you know, and walked in the same path that I've been, and been just tarred with the same PTSD brush as everyone else. And I fundamentally didn't agree with that. I don't think that was the case at all.
Mm. You did a lot of, you're an intelligent man and you are astute, and you research, and you did this in the, I suppose, your own self-recovery, self-compassion. I don't think it was self-medication.
No.
But it was certainly, you were doing things to try and make the situation better. You were on the rise again.
Yeah. I mean, I looked at myself a couple of times and I could see what was happening to me. The medication that they had me on for the best part of a year now, I was beginning to notice little strange quirks and little strange neuroses in my behaviour. My short-term memory was being impacted. I was also going to mention it before we came on here. Sometimes I can be holding a conversation, a subject that I know all about, know back to front, I know all my P's and Q's, and I'll be telling you about it, quite the thing, and suddenly I'll lose my train of thought, and it'll take me 5-10 seconds to rewind and go, right, what was I saying? And to get myself back on track. And I noticed that happening a lot in the early state. Like I said, 6 months into this heavily prescribed sort of stint of recovery, you know, there was the antipsychotic medication, there was antidepressants, there was sleeping tablets, there was anti-anxiety medication. They tried me on a bunch of things. Problem is, I'm quite tolerant to a lot of medication, so things would work for maybe a week and then they wouldn't. And I'd raise a complaint about it and they'd try and change it. So they bounced me about off of 10 plus medications, and all have left their little lasting effect on me to a greater or lesser extent. Some of them haven't, but and I noticed that in the first few sort of 6 to 12 months. So I was conscious that I didn't want to take these anymore. They weren't doing what I thought they should have been doing. I thought if I have a clear head and a clear perspective, rather than a sort of, you know, just that glass effect over my eyes. If I had a clear perspective, I can figure out what's happened, why it happened, what now, where now, and try and take baby steps forward. But I wanted to do it clear-minded, or not clear-minded, but I needed to get all the medication that I'd been recommended and told that would help. I had to get that out of my system and start it from afresh. And if it meant that coming off the medication made me feel worse, then so be it. That was something I was warned about. You know, you come off all these little things that you've been reliant on for the best part of a year, your body's going to have a negative reaction. And to be honest, I was happy to endure it regardless what the side effects were, because the side effects that I was seeing from them, it wasn't positive by any stretch of the imagination.
Why did you seek psilocybin, why did you seek magic mushrooms?
It was, again, I did, like you said, I did my own research. I had to try and figure out what's happened to me? Why has this happened to me? What could I have stopped it? And then, and try and just figure out a way of managing what I was feeling on a day-to-day basis. Now, this has left a lasting effect on me, and it does every day. And I've had to quickly try and figure out sort of a lot of coping strategies, a lot of coping mechanisms that I have to use on a daily basis, because the problem I have now is still huge frustration, and it's frustration more at the fact that I'm disabled off my own fruition. Do you know what I mean? I did this to myself. It causes me problems 20, 30, 40 times a day. Mm. And every time I have to breathe through it, I have to deal with it, I have to rely on an incredible sense of patience that I now have, which I never used to have before. And I found that when I was reading about what psilocybin could do, the benefits of it, and I had to give it a try. And I'd listened to a couple of different people do a couple of different lectures about it and what the benefits of it and stuff like that. And through a sort of accident, I got talking to somebody who went, actually, I know somebody who is a mycologist, who is, you know, his lifelong study has been about, you know, mycology. So we did a few inquiries, and I ended up getting my hands on some, and obviously did a bunch of research, spoke to this guy extensively, told him what had happened, and he recommended them. He says, you're the perfect candidate. He says, I've dealt with so many different people that have came through. A lot of them are ex-military guys, not quite had the same experience that you have, but everything was positive. All the experiences I'd heard or read of, they were all positive. So I was at the stage where I was willing to try anything else. I mean, I had never been a drug guy in my life. I'd been in the army all my life and never took drugs. I had a real strong anti-drugs policy. Leaving the military to go into the close protection world, we were heavily drug tested every time we came back from leave. So drugs were never something that played a part in my life. And if I'm being really honest, if you'd asked me about it 3 or 4 years ago, I would have went, druggy, you know, smoking that, taking that. You know, I have a real sort of, not a real opinion on it, but just have that sort of negative connotation attached to it. Like, what are you doing that for? You know, get a grip of yourself.
Class A fungus.
Yeah, exactly. But I knew anything had to be better than the medication that I'd been taking. So, like I said, the first time I took them was in my house, a really nice summer day. Had a real good experience.
What does it do to your brain?
I've explained it to a lot of people. I find the requirement hits me every 2 or 3 months, and I liken it to when your brain, everyone has a lot going on in their life, and you know, you've always got a lot in the back of your head, and sometimes I feel that I can really lose focus because I've got a lot of stuff flying around my head. So I liken it to, it rinses out my brain. If my brain's a sponge, a waterlogged sponge, you know, waterlogged with anxiety, waterlogged with problems and queries and little niggles and health problems, and I find that psilocybin acts like it just wrings out that sponge. It just wrings all the problems, all the issues, all the anxieties, all the niggling fears. It rings them out, or if it doesn't ring them out, it highlights them in such a fashion that you can see with real clear perspective the order of precedence of what you're worrying about. If you have, you know, you've got a real something, you've got a deadline to meet, or you've got something that's looming in the near future and you're worrying about it, it just gives you the ability to sort of take a step back and just sort of almost like reorganize it in front of yourself and just get a clearer perspective as to how you need to move forward, what needs to happen, when it needs to happen. It paints things in a real clear perspective, mate, and also gives you a huge sense of empathy, which doesn't sound like anything, but when you're dealing with certain issues and certain problems, having an enhanced level of empathy, I found over the past couple of years, has changed who I am. I went from being quite an aggressive, sort of hot-headed, typical jock, you know, who would go from zero to 60, you know, in no time whatsoever. I now find myself being a far more humble, a far more empathetic guy. Mm. I think before I speak, I always think about the person I'm talking to, what sort of day they're having, what's going on in their life. Think about their perspective and their emotions when I speak to somebody. I think it makes you a far better communicator. You can engage with people a lot more holistically. You can really get to know somebody a lot better through one of those experiences, because it just unlocks a part of you that maybe subconsciously we all keep locked up for whatever reason. It just accesses another part of your brain that I didn't knew exist.
Mm. And we're not advocating going down and getting your hands on magic mushrooms or any of the psychedelic. If you know, go to the Keith Abraham podcast and talk about heroic. You know, go and investigate and do your research and look at heroic hearts. But it is something that needs addressing, and it's, you know, these podcasts are here to declassify stigmas, if it is around, in our attempt to declassify drugs policy and what's going on here. I suppose the next step for you was employment. You then went and worked for ASDA.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a big step.
Huge step, yeah. I mean, the main problem I had is I got to the stage now, I was in my own mind, I was better. I'd gotten over the worst of it. I'd figured out what had went wrong. I'd figured out what I'd done to myself. I'd figured out a way of coping with the disability that I've got. I found a way of coping with the frustration and the anxiety that being disabled causes me. And the next hurdle I had to get over was asking somebody for a job, which for me wasn't a big deal, but I was going for a job as the delivery driver. So first and foremost, you have to be able to drive. And I'd never been behind the wheel of a car for the best part of a year because I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to drive safely. Mm. Thankfully I was, but the first thing that they do is they put you through a driving assessment. So the guy's there scrutinizing your driving ability, and he saw that I've got maybe a slightly different method of changing gear. So he's obviously went, you've got a bit of a issue going on there. So it's one of those things, it's a difficult thing to drop on somebody when you've just met them. You know, what happened to your wrist to drop that story on them when you've just met them and you're trying to get a job out of somebody is a lot. So, and it still is, you know, dropping that sort of knowledge on somebody, telling them you tried to take your own life in a really, really deliberate and really quite violent way. Everyone sort of takes a step back and sort of raises an eyebrow. But again, that was something I just had to get on with and swallow and just almost accept it and own it rather than being embarrassed about what I've done and try and hide away from it. I think that I found that just made the problem worse. The best way to deal with it is to completely own it and tell everyone exactly what had happened and not shy away from it. And to live it, because denying what I've done is not helping anything. So it's living with it and living with the problems that it gives me is the best way to deal with it.
So from the suicide attempt to becoming employed again, mm-hmm. and getting up day to day and getting out and working, that was 2 years.
Yeah.
You then came over to us.
Yeah.
So you work with us now. You're an amazing team member, mate. Really integral.
Thank you, mate.
You've been with us just less than a year, and you know the values and your empathy and all that stuff you just talked about, your patience and all the rest, it's amazing. This isn't a evaluation. But one thing that came off the back of that is, you know, we are part of a team, a pest control company.
Yeah.
We employ military veterans, and we have understanding around disability and psychological and trauma issues and all the rest of it. And I was teaching you how to, I was showing you how to do some bed proofing.
Yeah.
It's a big bed net, 150 metres away from where we are now. And we was, you know, 15 metres up on a cherry picker, and we had a little conversation. I said, I didn't really understand about your hand.
Yeah.
And I said, let's have a look, show me. And then that night, so Alexandra Craig, who's a top plastic surgeon, did more reconstructive operations on the Afghan and Iraq court than anyone else.
Yeah.
She's amazing. And we've podcasted with her, she's got her own episode. And I said, oh, go listen to this episode. Go listen to Alex's episode. You know, Cy Harmer, who was episode, I think, 8, he introduced me to Alex. Then we would do Alex. And then you figure out that Alex is operating on people like JJ. And then I messaged JJ and said, look, do you think I could contact Alex again? Although we knew each other and I had her number.
Yeah.
One thing led to another, and then you're down in Southampton and she's assessing you, and you're now going through the process to try and get some function back into the hand.
Yeah. I mean, she's fantastic. She's a human being. And she does it in such an uncompromising, just sort of blasé way. She's looking at you, just looking at the devastation that I've caused on my arm and wrist, and going, yeah, I could probably do that, and I could probably take a bit from there, and I could probably put it there, and I could get a couple of those, and I could fit that, and yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's the most selfless individual, you know, but you can see the determination and the vigor that she has for her job to just help people.
Mm.
She's fantastic, mate. So yeah, she's in the process now. She's done a first round of tests, testing all the nerves to see what nerve function I have, what blood flow function I have. She's just got a couple other tests to do it before she can start planning some sort of operation to try and restore. Function is probably going to be more so than feeling, because all my nerves are completely severed and stuff like that. So that's never going to be something that comes back. But I think function, she thinks she's maybe confident she can get a little bit more function in the hand, which would be, to be honest, mate, a complete and utter game changer, because, you know as well as I do, I've got little or no movement in it.
Mm.
It's the theoretical equivalent of putting a sock on your left hand and going to work every day. So
don't get too much function though, because you saved me a fortune in parking rather than security.
Disabled badge.
No, it's amazing. Actually, it's this full circle. You know, why we set, you know, myself and Des set the company. Sean, Sean was episode 8. Si was episode 5. You know, Sean coming to the company, does everything he does and the way he operates, and it gives me time to do the podcast.
Yeah.
And then the vision and everything behind what we do. Then bring people in. It's not an issue. And you understand, and it's kind of a message to an employer, really, just understand and show empathy, and you're going to get good people, and you're going to build a good team. And we don't get things right all the time, but, you know, this is something, that introduction could, I really hope it does give you that function back.
Yeah.
What's, just to kind of end in a sec, what's your relationship with your mental health like now?
I think we're in a pretty good place. Especially the last year. I think coming on board and starting a new job at Combat is projecting me back into that sort of team, having good people around me, people that I know that I can trust, people that I know that I can rely on. If I have a problem, I can phone them. Having that team spirit around me is fundamental. There's issues with me every day, mate, and it's going to be the case for the rest of my life. They're not really possessing, really overpowering, negative, you know, really dark thoughts. It's just I deal with daily frustration purely because, through my own intentions, I'm pretty disabled now. So, but again, coming from somebody who was a very, very bad tempered, very hot headed person, I've now got patience that I never thought I never thought was possible. My wife said the same thing. I was just one of the most impatient men she's ever met. But I've now, through necessity more than anything else, I've just developed a real calm demeanour, a lot more methodical in how I approach things, a lot more calm and empathetic. And again, I think that comes back to the experiences I've had with psilocybin. It gave me an ability to really explore who I was at the time of injury, and who I am now, and what the difference between the two people are, and how I've evolved from that person that I was to this person that I am now, and I'm saying that they definitely helped me develop the way that I think, and the way that I act, and the way that I interact with other people, and it goes back to empathy, mate, and being empathetic, and being as compassionate with people as possible. I find My old man used to say, you get more in life with a smile than you do with a skill. It's pretty accurate.
Stephen, thank you so much, and we will leave it there.